This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Wells Fargo is still in the news due to ongoing troubles. President Trump is about to announce his choice. I think he has announced his choice to head the Fed. And consumer protections against banks are weakened. We talk about all of these things later in the program. But we start with the recent opportunity to talk about challenges facing Charlotte that thousands took advantage of. On the Table Charlotte was patterned on similar events in other cities, bringing to the table people who might not ordinarily meet, much less exchange ideas, on how to make our city more inclusive and opportunity rich. But that's what happened a week or so ago, and we're going to spend the first part of the program talking to some of the organizers and participants to find out what was said and where this effort goes from here. Diane English is one of the organizers and the director of the Community Building Initiative. She is with us at the table, our table here. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Reverend Frederick Robinson, another organizer, is director of Mecklenburg Ministries. He's also joining us. Welcome to you. Good morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Diane Chips Bailey attended one of the discussions. She's an attorney at Robinson Bradshaw and pretty active in the community because we've had her on to talk about other things in this community. Thank you for coming back.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Michelle Gubadia is also an attendee and a director of fraternity and sorority life at UNC Charlotte.
Good morning.
Welcome. Good morning. Well, this idea, as I said, started in Chicago to bring people together in small mealtime conversations, at least in that city, to talk about how to make neighborhoods stronger and safer and more dynamic. The Knight Foundation supplied funding to expand those conversations to, I think, 18 cities around the country. Charlotte. More than 18?
No, less.
Okay, less. Oh, excuse me. How many cities?
10.
10, okay.
10 in all.
So we were one of them, one of
That's
those
right.
10. Who decided that Charlotte would participate?
I would imagine it came from the Knight Foundation because they're Knight cities. So the 10 cities that were involved, Chicago has been doing this for about 5 years.
Okay.
Miami's done it more than once, so they were a repeat. And then they added 8 additional Knight cities to be part of the process.
And when you say Knight cities, these are cities in which Knight used to own newspapers.
That's right, exactly, Mike. And so that's how the initial, I think, cut was made. And in most of the cities, there's a connection with their local community foundation.
Okay.
So in our case, it was Knight Foundation, Foundation for the Carolinas, and then Community Building Initiative helped to manage the project.
So this has been going on for 5 years in Chicago.
That's right.
What's come out of it? In Chicago.
Well, lots and lots of people. I mean, they estimate 55 to 100,000 people in this last one. And so lots of people have been engaged from all over. Of course, they have a much larger footprint and a lot more people. Mm-hmm. But so that's why we took as our goal to engage 5,000 people on one day from throughout the community, as many zip codes and areas as we could touch and involve.
How many people? That was the goal, 5,000.
Yes.
How many
yeah.
people actually participated? Do you
well,
know?
Well, we estimate that over 5,000 people participated. So the way, you know, it's hard. We didn't do a nose-by-nose count.
Okay.
But we know who committed to host, how many they committed to involve. We had people downloading the guide. We had people participating last weekend, even after the event was over.
Hmm.
So, you know, it is very organic in many ways and very organized in other ways.
Now, we talk a lot about a lot of different issues in this city, and we do a lot of planning, but mostly we do a lot of talking. We talk on this program. We talk about people who have talked elsewhere on this program. How did this differ from other sessions where people get together and just talk about Charlotte's challenges, its problems, its strengths, its weaknesses?
I guess one of the ways it differed was the fact that we had all these discussions going on one day at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, conversations themselves will not change Charlotte, but I think we're better off when we're talking than when we're not. Our conversation revolved around the Opportunity Task Force report, and our question was, what role does the faith community play? And so our goal was to bring a diverse group of people from different faith traditions to talk about opportunity and poverty and what their different faith traditions taught them about their responsibility to those who are without. And I believe it was a lively, energetic conversation, mm-hmm. and we had a lot of different points of views.
Didn't all of these groups concentrate on various aspects of the Economic Opportunity Task Force report? Wasn't that the goal, at least?
Well, a connecting theme was social capital. And especially since leading on opportunity is a very a hot topic right now and should be. And so we used as – we provided every group that was organizing a conversation, a host kit, a guide, so that there'd be conversation prompts. And the suggestion was that you build it around social capital and what connects us and what doesn't at times and what the barriers are to connection. So they had the conversation prompts. The guidance from Knight Foundation was maximum flexibility. So if somebody ended up talking about the Panthers for 90 minutes, that was their issue. But if they followed the prompt, as you remember from Leading on Opportunity, one of the overarching themes was social capital and our lack of connectivity in this community.
Well, the Opportunity Task Force report found most of us live segregated lives.
That's right.
We may work together, we may go to certain things, events together, but for the most part, we resegregate when we go to our communities, we resegregate on Sunday morning, et cetera, et cetera. We don't talk to each other, we don't know each other's stories. I think key word in that sentence, I think, is stories.
Right.
Why is that so important? Why is knowing someone else's story important? You're nodding your head, Michelle, so I'll give it to you.
I think that's where empathy comes from. When you understand what people have walked, how they got here, what pulled them to Charlotte, why do they stay, understanding that story and that narrative makes them human and makes you want to have compassion and want to know your neighbor and support your neighbor. And I think that's why knowing the story is very important.
And I would also imagine that the story may be different from the stereotype.
Absolutely. We all make, biases and things that play into our narrative of other people. But once they open their mouth and they share who they are, what makes them tick and why they're here, all of that goes out the window. Now you have the real truth in front of you. And I think we need to do, like you said, we have to do more talking to understand that.
Diane, you're also nodding.
I am, because the talking, as you point out, is important, but the listening is even more important. I mean, to be present and intentional in your listening, to understand those stories, to help to build the trust that is so desperately needed, to really be courageous enough to move our city forward.
Did the people in these groups, and how many groups were there, 40, something like that?
Oh, no. We had probably 200, over 200 or more groups. You had groups from, 6 or 8. You had groups that were close to 200.
So did the people in these groups, were they can you tell, have you tabulated, have you figured out yet whether they were representative of all walks of life, all different socioeconomic backgrounds?
Well, we went from Davidson to Matthews. We went to Pineville. We went to, I understand there were some at Gardner-Webb. And so we were down in Fort Mill.
Would you have found people of different socioeconomic backgrounds at most of those different sessions? Or would you, for instance, I think yours was at what country club?
Myers Park Country Club.
So if I walked into the session at Myers Park Country Club, what would I have found?
You found 200 professional women.
By design, or just who signed up?
It was sponsored by Women United, which is one of the affinity groups within the United Way for Central Carolinas. And it was an interesting group of women. The tables were randomly assigned. Mm-hmm. I was a table leader, and I sat down, and half of the women I would consider to be close friends.
Right.
Again, pure serendipity. And the other half were new to me, but we had just shared experience in our professional lives and our personal lives, commitment to philanthropy that helped us very quickly to find common ground to then launch into a conversation about the opportunity.
But if you meet at a country club and it's a bunch of professional women, how are you breaking down barriers and increasing understanding of the other, who probably would feel uncomfortable coming to a country club to have this conversation?
That's an absolutely fair question. And I will tell you that personally, I've made a real commitment over the last couple of years to try to break out of my silo, picking up the phone to call folks that I've barely been introduced to have these conversations. And I think showing up and recognizing that we have issues ahead of us and taking that first step, regardless of the context of that first step, is a very important statement, statement to yourself, and then provides a platform to then reach beyond further into the community.
And this is the difficulty, it would seem to me, of all of these meetings, no matter where they were, place is important as to where you have it in terms of attracting people. And there will be people who would be uncomfortable at Myers Park Country Club. There would be people who would be uncomfortable meeting on the west side at a library or perhaps with your group because they're not Christian. And you talked, Reverend, about how faith can get involved in all of this. So how do you bring people in? How do you encourage them to get out of their comfort zone and be uncomfortable or potentially be uncomfortable, not only in the conversation but in the place?
The way we do it as an interfaith organization, we have been accused of being mostly Christian. Mm-hmm. So we have to be intentional about allowing other voices to rise to the table. So we had a Buddhist who spoke. We also had someone from the Baha'i community. And we had a number of other houses of worship that were represented there. As we believe interfaith dialogue widens our world. And so we are real intentional about bringing different voices to the table. And that's how we build those bridges across differences. And location, of course, is important.
Did you have a good cross-section of people there, do you think?
I believe we had a good cross-section of the faith community there, absolutely. I believe we did, and the conversations were rich and challenging. If you look at Charlotte's faith community, mm-hmm. It runs from conservative to liberal to progressive, and we try to broaden our tent to allow all those voices to come through the table.
Michelle, where was yours, and what was your turnout like?
We were at UNC Charlotte, so that's a diverse community of students, faculty, staff, and stakeholders who are at the university. So at my table, I was with people who are native to Charlotte. We had lots of transplants like myself and students who are immigrants, students who are from different parts of the area of the state. So we had a good cross-section. We had 76 people participate all together in our two sessions at UNC Charlotte, and it was a good cross-section of people. However, I want to go back to her statement about being at Myers Park and 200 professional women showing up. To me is inspiring. 200 professional women showed up to have a conversation. That's the first step. Create a space where people could have a conversation, where ideas can be challenged, because those women are going to leave their chain. So It doesn't bother me that, maybe it wasn't the most diverse group of women. You can definitely invite me next time. I'm happy to come to Myers Park. But I think they just showed up to have a conversation and dialogue. People of the faith community showed up to have a dialogue. The cross-section will come later. The fact that people are showing up to talk about things that implicate us is good.
Diane English, you may have had maybe of the four people sitting at this table, the greatest success of finding a cross-section. You had yours at, Google Fiber down
the
street.
We pulled people off the street. But I also got to see five others. And the last one I went to was at Geringer High School. And it was a teacher with 12 of her students. And it was the most inspiring. I mean, to say your voice is important. You're part of this community. You're the future mm-hmm. in many ways. To hear them talk about, the lack of AP classes or the challenges, and then to hear them talk about how they're going to leverage themselves to go to the school board and, to be active. And so to know, for all of us to know that conversation took place, there was 80 people at the Hindu Center. There were folks out at Jail North, a group of incarcerated teens. Mm. So what I'm saying is that you all know this, that this is happening, and that people feel that their voices matter.
When we come back, we'll talk about some of the things that came up in these conversations. And when we return in a moment, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Habitat Charlotte Restores, where donations of furniture, books, and appliances are sold to create affordable housing. Four locations, including University City and now in Pineville. More at charlotterestore.org. And Charlotte Regional Partnership, which markets the 16-county, two-state region known as Charlotte, USA. The company's looking to expand or relocate in our market. Information about supporting the effort at charlotteusa.com. Well, our roundtable of reporters gathers tonight, not tomorrow, tonight, at Birdsong Brewery in Noda to talk about the local election. We've got a big one coming up on Tuesday with the mayor and city council races and school board races, and our panel of reporters will talk about that at Birdsong Brewery tonight at 6. You can be there, but if you can't be there for some reason, you can join us tomorrow morning at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, what we are learning about the New York terror attack and tough questions, including, do we have to accept life with soft target attacks? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point, coming up at 10, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about On the Table, which took place here for the first time a week and a half or so ago, in which over 5,000 people gathered at different locations around town to talk about Charlotte, to talk about becoming involved, to talk about the challenges that Charlotte faced, what they could or could not do, how and to make connections, to make connections between each other, diverse people who probably would not have met each other in many circumstances had it not been for this event. Diane English is one of the organizers, director of the Community Building Initiative, Reverend Frederick Robinson, another of the organizers, executive director of Mecklenburg Ministries, both here with us, along with Diane Chips Bailey, another Diane, an attorney at Robinson Bradshaw, and Michelle Gubadia. There we go.
Perfect.
Michelle Gubadia, Director of Fraternity and Sorority Life at UNC Charlotte, both participants in these. There were probably as many topics as there were meetings, but what did people talk about? What did they want to talk about? Let me begin with you, Diane Bailey. What did people at your group want to talk about?
Our group very quickly went to the priorities identified by the Opportunity Task Force report. The fact that Leading on Opportunity, at least for the women who committed to come in support of the Women United event sponsored by the United Way, it is clear that Leading on Opportunity is imprinted in their DNA. Mm-hmm. They were so fluid in their ability to talk about needs around affordable housing, education, family stability, digital inclusion, the list went on and on. It really was striking to me, you know, as someone who's very involved in the community. If I rewind even a year, the fact that they wouldn't even have had the vocabulary, I don't think, to talk about these issues, much less to elevate them as the most important priorities for our city. I found that to be very encouraging.
Michelle, at your group, what did they want to talk about?
Well, we had students, and so many students there, concerns came to the forefront, the light rail being one of them. The last stop on the new light rail is right on our campus, and how that would provide access to the rest of the city and people coming to UNC Charlotte and seeing what our campus has to provide, but also the diversity that it would open people to. They talk about parts of the community that people just don't go to, and how there is so much culture in the fabric of Charlotte, and how students can really be exposed to street festivals and different ways of thinking and different community cultures all around the Charlotte area. And we ended up trading the best place to get, you know, Greek food, the best place to get Indian food, and that was all over the community. And just to hear from students that they had gotten out of their UNC Charlotte bubble to explore the city was really inspiring to some of us who, you know, we live in one area of the city, and I was like, I never knew that existed on that side of town. I need to go check that out. So it was really about expanding our reach and reaching out to different cultural segments of our community and bringing that back to UNC Charlotte and that light rail giving us access to it.
Reverend Robinson.
We talked about the role of the faith community. And one of the things that came out was the fact that too often the faith community has been silent and absent in the struggle to live the world's vision for justice and inclusion and radical hospitality and radical love. And so that challenge was issued, that the church has to be more at the forefront in combating and talking about these issues. In the Hebrew Bible, Micah 6 and 8 says, "Thou has already told you what is required of you, that is to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with the Lord." And so that challenge is something that needs to be embraced. And that's one of the things many of the people talked about. What can we do to lift society's vision? You know, we have a captive audience. Most houses of worship have a captive audience. And if you can begin to talk about compassion and justice and kindness and radical love, you can help shift and change the culture around these things. So there's a lot of talk going on in Charlotte, but we have to be intentional about moving beyond the conversation to coming up with specific strategies to make a difference.
And Diane English, you went to several, as we said a minute ago. One of them was down the street here at Google Fiber, and then you went to jail.
I did not. No, that was not an open. That was a closed conversation. But I went to Geringer. I went to the McMinn one. I went to one that Novant sponsored. We had for-profit. We had non-profit. You had big employers. You had very small groups.
Did the topics being discussed vary widely from those different places?
No, well, they varied. You could imprint your own. But, you know, they had questions, back to your point, of who's not at our table. You know, what's the intention that we could have to enlarge our table? So it really broached the subjects from a wide vantage point. You know, what's the issue of consequence to you and your neighbors? We tried to make it very personal, Mike, because when people get invested in something, then they'll move to action. But they first have to feel connected. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we know is important about an effort like this. It's an easy way to connect.
Was it awkward at the beginning? Because you have people who've never met each other sitting around these tables, in rooms full of people sitting around tables, and you have a facilitator at each table who then has to kind of at least kickstart the conversation. Yeah.
If we sat here at the group we have right now and we said, what connects you to this community? Name something. It could be, you know, the place you work out. It could be your housework. It could be a club you belong to. It could be the fact that you were born here, but you still don't feel connected, or you moved here and you feel very connected. Well, what connects you? We all have that story. We have a Charlotte story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea. Our friend Amalia Jaloney says the shortest distance between two people is a story. And so you start with that kind of question. And people, it's amazing. It's not hard to get people to talk. It's hard to get them get quiet and listen, as Diane Bailey says. But that's why it was. And if you're around a dinner table, or if you're around in a coffee shop, if you're someplace that's of your choice, or you've been invited, that's the key, inviting somebody to be a part of it.
Talking is only one side of the equation. Oh. You just said listening, and that's interesting because people don't always listen, or they want to participate in the conversation. So while you're saying something, they're formulating what they're about to say, and they're not really listening to you.
No.
Did people listen, do you think? Did they take away something that changed their minds about something or enlightened them to give them something to chew on as they left?
I believe they did. There were several people. We had people come to the microphone after their table discussions to summarize what their table talked about. And there were several who talked about, yes, they heard the problems and that they were motivated and inspired to do something about it. There was one table said they were going to get back together to talk about these issues and come up with some plan of action. And so I think obviously there has to be deep listening.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that we had different communities present their vision from their faith tradition about how to reach out and help these communities that are in need. You know, all faith traditions has a, sort of a golden rule. And I love the Baha'i traditions. It says, lay not on any soul a weight that you would not want laid upon you. And in Charlotte, poverty is a load.
Michelle.
I think so. There was an exchange of ideas. There was a range in age. So the younger students at our session were teaching us stuff on our phones. They're like, oh, no, you need to download this. And I'm like, download what? So there was this exchange, which was cool that they felt comfortable enough to teach us something because we were listening and we were giving them a space and a voice to tell us what makes you tick here.
She just mentioned technology. Oh. This seems to me this particular exercise seems to be well suited for some kind of social media platform.
Oh, absolutely.
And we had a great social media. I mean, that was the strongest way to recruit and to spread the message.
And to continue the conversation.
Exactly. And so thank you, because talking about downloading something, you can go to the on the tableclt.org website. Download the conversation guide. Yesterday I had two people say, I'm going to have this conversation again. And I said, well, download the guide. Nothing stops you. Invite a group of people to your home. Meet a group of people somewhere. Mm-hmm. Download the guide. Use the conversation prompts. Have your own conversation. Someone said, what do I do now? I think, well, you are with people, kind of like Fred was saying. Talk about what you can do. Mm-hmm. There's plenty. And if you're thinking about locally, you know, what's important to you? What's important to your neighbors? Get working on that. And so we'll be getting the survey data back. Everybody who participated has a chance to take the on-the-table survey. The University of Chicago will be analyzing that data. It has Charlotte-specific questions. Some are the questions asked in the other nine cities, but some are specific to Charlotte. And we'll get that data back early 2018.
So you have
a chance to analyze that.
So
and
you
learn
don't
from
know
it.
Yet if because the survey hasn't come back.
Not until
do you
early.
Know if any overarching concerns emerged, anecdotally at least, from these sessions?
I can anticipate that from what I heard, people are concerned about our connectivity mm-hmm. and leading on poverty rates and what our future holds. But even before this started, at one of the early planning meetings, there was a connection made between Sustain Charlotte and Bruns Academy. So they made a connection. Who knows what's going to happen? See, I'm very hopeful that you don't know what's going to happen when a pebble lands in the pond and people say, we could do this.
I think what you're pointing out, Diane, is exactly right. There's something really magical about these episodic interactions that are high impact and really facilitated in a thoughtful and intentional way. They're generative, and what can come forward is, I think, where the opportunity for the silos to break down, and that's being in service together. Mm-hmm. I think everyone would agree that when you have the opportunity to really build relationships outside of the segregated lives we live, residentially, educationally, certainly in places of worship, is when you're in service to our community together, whether that's through nonprofit or political engagement. I mean, those are the real opportunities to develop relationships that lead to the trust, again, that's got to underlie any meaningful change.
Let me share some of the comments that have come in from listeners as they've been listening away here. Sean on Facebook says, the people that participate in these groups and events are not the problem. They want to get involved and be part of the solution. So how do you get people that are not as eager to bridge the race, wealth, socioeconomic gap to talk?
So if we do if that were a charge to any of us, you organize another kind of conversation. You get folks who have maybe connections with those that you'd like to see involved. You get them to issue the invitation. Because that is the Fred knows and Michelle knows, if you want to get folks involved in whatever,
but as
you
we
issue
know,
the invitation.
But as we know, we want to live in our echo chamber and we want to have our already held beliefs reemphasized. That's how people choose the news outlet that they consume. So how do you get people who don't want to hear this to hear it?
I think a lot of them are in houses of faith. And again, if we can change the conversation, we can be intentional about talking about poverty and opportunity in our faith, in our houses of worship, then we can inspire, I think, and motivate and even challenge some people to get out of their comfort zones.
So, but big employers, UNCC is a big employer, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Fifth Third, Novant, Carolina's Healthcare, they're big employers. They have diverse groups of people in their employee base. They serve a diverse community. So having them involved and on the table also puts you, Mecklenburg County, City of Charlotte, they are big employers. And not everybody who works and serves in those places think alike. Mm. So if entities like that committed to on the table.
Where does this go from here?
Always a good question. You know, many cities are going to replicate on the table in 2018. Charlotte may be one of them. We mentioned the survey data. I think there's a great opportunity to stay connected with the people who were involved initially and spread the word, like Diane and Fred and Michelle have said. But download the guide, learn more, take it upon yourself. Everybody's connected to somebody.
I have to cut this off, but sure. I have to ask this question. Is there Is it important to turn these things that you've learned from these group discussions into action, or is it simply important that the discussions were held and that action will take place organically because people have had their eyes opened?
So is it possible to believe that talking is action? We know the damage that talking is doing right now in our country. We know the challenges we face because of talk and words. Isn't it possible to believe that talking, intentional, focused, meaningful conversation is action? And engaging people in that in a deliberative way is action. That would be an outcome of value.
Diane English is the director of the Community Building Initiative, one of the organizers of On the Table Charlotte. Reverend Frederick Robinson, another organizer, is executive director of Mecklenburg Ministries. Diane Chips Bailey, attorney at Robinson Bradshaw, participated in one of these sessions. She's participated in a lot of stuff over time. She is a community activist. Michelle Gabadia is director of Fraternity and Sorority Life at UNC Charlotte, also a participant. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, it seems there is no escaping scrutiny for Wells Fargo. Already embroiled in controversy for its fake account scandal, federal prosecutors are now looking into the bank's foreign exchange trading. It's a new area of focus for investigators and has already led to the ouster of four employees. And regulators are also looking at an auto insurance program the bank has since abandoned, but which could still cost it tens of millions of dollars. We're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about those and other Wells-related issues, and we'll also look into what might come from the Senate striking down consumer protections that would have allowed millions of Americans to band together in a class action lawsuit against financial institutions, and President Trump naming a new or his choice for to lead the Fed going forward. And joining us to fill us in on all of that and more is the Charlotte Observer's banking reporter, Dion Roberts. Welcome back.
Hi, Mike.
Good to see you.
Here.
These stories just keep coming out of Wells Fargo. This is Tim Sloan in mid-October talking to CNBC about earnings being slightly dinged by all the things going on, but he was still optimistic.
We're in the midst of transforming Wells Fargo. We've made fundamental changes in terms of how we're organized, fundamental changes in our retail bank in terms of how folks are being compensated. Mm-hmm. We're turning over every rock in the company, and we're making really good changes.
So, this for a banking reporter, this seems to be the gift that keeps on giving, because every day it seems like there's something new. Is it because they are turning over every rock, as he just said, at the bank, or is it because they keep finding new things, outside investigators keep finding new things?
Yeah, they've really, it's been a busy year. I mean, as a banking reporter, you're right. The bank has been investigating itself outside of the consumer bank, which is where the sales practices that we all heard about in September of last year occurred. Mm-hmm. So as they look internally, they're discovering things. The New York Times, though, was actually the first to report in July on the auto insurance scandal. And it was after the New York Times reported on the scandal. They got a copy of a report that was written for the bank on this auto insurance problem. Then Wells Fargo said, yes, that is something that we discovered internally. They admitted to it. So I would point out that it was the New York Times that first disclosed it. But yes, to answer your earlier question, lots of things have come out. And the question is there more?
Yeah. And we have lots to talk about, just about the things that have come out before we even ask the question, is there more? And we'll do that as we go forward for the rest of this hour with Dion Roberts from the Charlotte Observer. We have to take a break. We'll come right back. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Actors Theater of Charlotte, presenting the Broadway comedy Hand to God, about a Christian ministry puppet possessed by the devil. November the 8th through the 25th. Tickets and info at atcharlotte.org. And Foundation for the Carolinas, working with companies such as Map Anything to maximize charitable impact in the community. Information at givebusinessinterests.org. Well, this week's attack in New York City marked the U.S. arrival of a kind of terror attack we've seen overseas, those involving vehicles. Similar attacks have taken place, of course, in London and Berlin and elsewhere. And so on point today in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, we'll look at the vulnerability of so-called soft targets and the latest on the attack in New York earlier this week. That's coming up. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment, and you can join it at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We'll be talking about Wells Fargo, among other things. Stay with us.
What can be done to compel Charlottetians to regularly be with residents of different races, classes, lifestyles, and beliefs? A listener submitted that question to the WFAE Newsroom through our Ask Us feature, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on the topic. Have you found ways to interact with people different from you? What gets you there, or what gets in the way? Share your thoughts by leaving a message at 704-879-3536 or by going online to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dion Roberts is with us from the Charlotte Observer for the rest of the program to talk about banking news and information, a lot of which centers around Wells Fargo. Days ago, Wells Fargo fired four bankers in its foreign exchange unit, but they provided no details at the time on those departures or the investigation that seems to have led to those departures. Have we found out anything more since then?
We found out that it involves one client and one trade. Apparently, the client is Restaurant Brands International. You'll know them as the parent company of they own Popeyes,
Burger
Louisiana
King.
Kitchen, Burger King, and Tim Hortons. It was a single trade. Four bankers have departed from the company. One of those, it looks like, was based here in Charlotte. Wells Fargo's investment bank, which is where, and corporate bank, which is where this activity, alleged activity, took place, has a big presence in Charlotte. In the Duke Energy building, there's a trading floor. So there is maybe a Charlotte tie-in here.
So this is a new area for the bank. Most of the investigations have been in the retail banking area. This is the investment banking area. Should that be of concern, or is this just one isolated incident? And this happens at lots of companies from time to time. We shouldn't be all that shaken up about this.
I think there was a lot of money involved in this deal, and it's a big client. And Warren Buffett is a shareholder of Restaurant Brands International, so that brings some additional interest to this transaction.
He's not a shareholder of Wells as well?
He is a shareholder. He's a very large shareholder of Wells Fargo. To your question about, the magnitude of this and at the timing of it, if this would have happened, Mike, 2 years ago, I don't think it would have been seen as a big deal at Wells Fargo. Mm-hmm. But it's just a particularly sensitive time for the bank to have more negative headlines come out about it.
And this comes just weeks after Tim Sloan, the chief executive at Wells, was taken to task during a Senate Banking Committee hearing for the bank's conduct and its culture. Senator Elizabeth Warren called for a wider-reaching change with the bank. She also called for Mr. Sloan's firing, as she did for his predecessor, John Stumpf. Is this investigation in the bank's foreign exchange area connected in any way? Or an indication that Senator Warren might be right, that more change needs to happen at the top?
I won't weigh in on whether she's right there. I will say that this does not help the bank's efforts to move past the sales scandal.
Does this speak to the corporate culture, or is this an isolated incident, perhaps?
I don't know enough about this particular trade to really say whether it's part of a larger corporate culture issue. But I will say that there continue to be concerns that I hear from some Wells Fargo employees that sales pressure does still exist in certain parts of the bank. Other employees have said that they feel like it's a new page has been turned at the bank.
But doesn't sales pressure exist in every business in the country?
It does. And, these jobs, these banking jobs, these frontline banking jobs, tellers and personal bankers are advertised as sales positions. If you go on monster.com, a lot of these positions require you to have some sort of sales experience. But there's been a question about whether these truly should be sales jobs in the wake of Wells Fargo scandal. I think it was in one of the hearings, might have been the Senate hearing, that John Stumpf, the former CEO, testified at last year after the scandal erupted. But someone brought up, why isn't this a needs-based thing that banks do? In other words, why don't you just wait for someone to come in the door, tell you what they need, and then you meet that need as opposed to pushing things on them that maybe they don't want. Mm-hmm. And then if you incentivize bankers on top of that to provide a certain number of products, then does that create a conflict of interest for the banker who, in order for that person to get a bonus, needs to sell X number of products?
Right.
And even though Wells Fargo got rid of its sales goals, other banks continue to have sales goals.
And I guess the natural question would arise, if that's what's happening in the retail bank, what's happening in the investment bank with selling things that people don't want, don't need, and perhaps are not appropriate for them, but that do generate big commissions for the broker and big money for the bank?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you know, a lot of people are still at Wells Fargo who were at Wells Fargo, you know, when the sales scandal was happening in the retail bank. Now, they have terminated some people. Obviously, the CEO is not there anymore. But there are still people there, Mike, who've been there for a long time. And I think it's a good question about culture in other parts of the bank.
So the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, that's a fancy title, mm-hmm. has issued a report criticizing Wells for forcing hundreds of thousands of borrowers to buy unneeded auto insurance when they took out a car loan. The practice came to light in July, as you said, when the New York Times came out about this. And the report from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency goes on to criticize the bank for how it has handled the situation since the problem was detected. How unusual is it for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency to get involved or issue a report about the operations of a bank?
It's very common because
because
the OCC is one of, you know, a handful of big regulators that monitor the banks, including the Federal Reserve, including the Securities and Exchange Commission, and including the CFPB, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So it's quite common. And the OCC is actually one of the agencies that fined Wells Fargo last year for the sales scandal.
So they set aside the report says that Wells had most likely underestimated how much it would cost to reimburse their customers, the ones that were harmed. Mm-hmm. And they set aside $80 million to compensate 570,000 customers who said they were harmed. Again, this happened because the bank was overzealous in focusing on sales volume and performance and not on the problem signs or on consumer complaints. How much money has Wells spent to rectify all these things with their customers?
All the scandals?
Yeah.
It's in the more than $100 million easily.
I think it might be more than that.
It is. I mean, I don't have a tally for you.
The bank reported that third quarter earnings took a hit from an old problem, legal costs from mortgage practices that led to the financial crisis. Earnings fell 18% from a year ago after the bank set aside $1 billion. To cover expenses associated with the mortgage investigations, $1 billion there, $80 million to make customers in the insurance scandal right, $3.4 million to settle claims that brokers recommended investment products that they did not fully understand, perhaps more money set aside or already spent on writing the bogus accounts. Isn't this adding up to a big critical mass of cash?
It is, and I should have said instead of $100 million, what I meant to say was hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
But you know, you're talking about a bank that makes $4.6 billion in profit, you know, in the recent quarter. So yeah, you know, it's a lot of money, but it's sort of a rounding error in the grand scheme of things, you know, for a bank that's bringing in tens of billions of dollars a year in revenue.
Yeah. Is that how they view it? Is that how shareholders view it? Is that how Warren Buffett views it, a principal stockholder? I mean, this is a rounding error. We
can
go around this. It'll be okay.
I hope not. I hope it doesn't. And I think that there are some people at the bank who don't take this lightly because this does hurt their reputation at the end of the day. It does bring the pressure of members of Congress and more regulatory scrutiny, which no bank wants.
Could they possibly be alone?
In
terms of how they operate and the damage being done to customers, in some cases, not all, and in how they view these things, could they possibly be alone, or are they just the ones that got caught?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the past, 8 years, I mean, since the financial crisis, I think we see examples of banks wrongdoing across the board. It's not just Wells Fargo.
Mm. Wells Fargo CEO Tim Sloan, we heard from him at the beginning, and he's predicted that the bank will achieve the growth it has lost during its fake accounts scandal. But with that, the foreign exchange investigation and the investigation into auto insurance practices, is that a realistic expectation? Is he just painting a rosy picture there, or is it really possible to regain trust and customer base, et cetera.
Well, one thing he also said was that he thinks he's the best person to be CEO, and that he's optimistic and he's confident, that things are going to get better. He's got to be optimistic publicly. You can't go out in front of cameras and say things aren't going to get better. I mean, he's got to do that. You mm-hmm. know, is the culture changing over there? Again, I hear from bankers at Wells Fargo who give me both, both versions, that things are getting better and things aren't. So
how much have they lost, either in terms of customer confidence or customer business, over all of this? Do you know? Does anybody know? Have they released those figures?
Yeah, that's a good question. So they used to put out these reports every month that showed in the retail bank how many credit card accounts were opened versus a year ago. How many checking accounts were open versus a year ago. I was looking at one from earlier this year. This is in March. And again, they discontinued doing these. But in March, the consumer checking account openings fell 35% from March a year before. So this would be March 2017, March 2016, 35% decrease. That's a lot. And then credit card applications, consumer credit card applications during the same period fell 42%. So this has impacted them in some way, but the bank has also said, Tim Sloan recently said, you talk about the CNBC interview, he said that our wealth management operation, for example, has been virtually untouched by this. Mm-hmm. So,
but their share price is down a little bit. It fell 3% in 2017. That doesn't sound like a lot considering all that's been going on, and not only there, but in the banking industry as well. That doesn't sound like a lot.
3% is not a lot, but keep in mind that bank stocks in general are soaring right now because of the hope of deregulation, tax cuts, and things like that. So for Wells to be down any amount is a sign that this continues. The scandals continue to be a drag.
So meanwhile, you have reported that an advocacy group for bank branch employees says there are still problems at Wells Fargo. What sorts of problems are they telling you about?
Well, this is
alleging, let's put it that way.
Right. So the Committee for Better Banks was created after the financial crisis. It's an advocacy group. Its founders are affiliated with the Communications Workers of America Union. And they wrote they met with Wells Fargo executives in June of this year, and they brought concerns to the bank. They said, number one, we need higher base pay, that, continuing to give bankers bonuses for opening accounts is sort of a bad practice. It's not good for consumers. Mm-hmm. Raise the base pay and so that people aren't feeling pressure to sell products and get a bonus for it. Then they said that there is a, quote, persistent, aggressive, close quote, sales culture still at the bank. And there are also fears of retaliation if you bring concerns about the workplace to the company. Now, Wells Fargo, after meeting with these people in June, these workers in June wrote a letter and said that we are addressing all of these things and that we have zero tolerance for retaliation. But again, I think it speaks to some workers. There's a perception that things haven't changed as much as they should at Wells Fargo.
And they spent about $500,000 on lobbyists, which also doesn't sound like a lot of money. And I'm sure that banks lobby Congress and Washington all the time. Is that an unusual amount of money? And what are they lobbying for?
It's a lot of money. For the board to have spent. And it is very unusual for a board to hire a law firm to do lobbying on its behalf. You almost never see this happen. If you look at corporate scandals in recent history, Volkswagen, Uber, even J.P. Morgan Chase with the London Whale scandal of recent years, the boards of those companies have never hired a lobbyist, ever.
Okay, so President Trump is about to announce, we'll change subject here, about to announce his choice to head the Fed. Janet Yellen has held the job for 4 years. Her term is up. She's one of the people who have been named as a possible next leader of the Fed, so she just maintained the job for 4 more years. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin is backing a member of the Fed already, Jerome Powell. But when he appeared before the Senate Banking Committee in June, he said he would not support some of Trump's deregulation ideas. And the other candidate is John Taylor, a Stanford economist. economist, also mentioned as a candidate, and he's a critic of the Fed's monetary policy. Where's the money going? Where's the betting money going here?
I think sources have pretty much these are White House sources who are saying it's going to be Jerome Powell, and I think 3 p.m. today is when we're going to have the announcement that Trump will nominate him.
But why? He likes Janet Yellen's approach to monetary policy. He wants to loosen the reins on regulation, and Jerome Powell doesn't support some of those deregulation ideas. Why would he make a change, particularly that change?
Well, he's not a disruptor, which is interesting because Trump likes to put people in who are going to shake things up and make big changes. I think that Trump is leaning toward him for two reasons. One is I think he's going to continue to gradually increase interest rates the way that Janet Yellen has, which is good for banks. They make more money when interest rates go up.
Sure.
And then also the perception is that he's going to gradually ease regulations, maybe not aggressively ease regulations, but gradually pull back on those, which again, that deregulatory approach is something that Trump likes. So I think it's sort of there's two reasons here why Trump likes him, I think.
We have less than a minute left, but last month Senate Republicans voted to strike down a new rule that would have allowed millions of Americans to band together in class action lawsuits against financial institutions. Vice President Pence had to cast the tie-breaking deciding vote. It will make it harder for individuals to sue banks, but the rule had not yet gone into effect. It wouldn't have gone into effect till 2019. This has to still go through the entire Congress, right, and be signed by the president for this to take effect.
Trump signed it yesterday.
He signed it yesterday.
So the rule is gone.
Why would they do that to consumers? Particularly a populist president, why would he do that to consumers?
Well, because the argument by many Republicans in the Treasury Department actually said, this is not a good rule. So I think the GOP didn't like it, and Trump is going where the GOP is on this issue.
Dion Roberts, banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We'll stay tuned this afternoon for his choice for the Fed. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.